Court now calls Everson against Associates in General and Vascular Surgery. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Benjamin Sachs, registration number 11034. I'm appearing today on behalf of Colin and Susan Everson, the plaintiff's appellants. In this case, we're asking the court to reverse the summary judgment that was entered by the trial court on a statute of limitations defense that had been raised by the defendant, Associates in General and Vascular Surgery, and to remand the case for a trial on the merits of the plaintiff's claim under the respondeat superior doctrine, as well as Associates' statute of limitations defense. Additionally, we're also asking the court to reverse a pretrial ruling that was made by the trial court with regard to the defendant's joinder in a designation of non-party of Lois Landgraf, which was based entirely on her alleged pre-presentment negligence that occasioned Mr. Everson's need for the emergency medical attention that he had received at Memorial Hospital. First issue, statute of limitations defense and the summary judgment that was granted on that. There's no factual dispute in this case as to when Mr. Everson actually had knowledge of the elements of the facts that are material to his claim based on the respondeat superior doctrine. Claim based on a respondeat superior doctrine requires proof that there's an employer-employee relationship and that the employee has committed acts or omissions within his course of employment for that employer. Now, in this case, there's no question based on the affidavit, and it's the only evidentiary material that was before the trial court in the record in this case, on the issue of the plaintiff's state of knowledge, that Mr. Everson did not know until October 15, 2004, that Dr. Everson, who was also a defendant in the case, was actually employed at the time of the complaint of events by Associates in General and Vascular Surgery rather than Memorial Hospital.
I don't think you mean Dr. Everson.
You're right. I meant Dr. Clemens. Thanks for the correction. So in this case, the affidavit demonstrates when the timing of Mr. Everson's knowledge, actual knowledge of that material fact.
Now, let's go back. Would you start with what's the standard here for accrual of a cause of action and what's your authority for that?
Okay. In determining when an action accrues for statute of limitations purpose, the Supreme Court of Colorado has held that a claim for relief does not accrue until the plaintiff knows or should know in the exercise of reasonable diligence all material facts essential to show the elements of that cause of action. Miller versus Armstrong World Industries, Inc., 817 P. 2nd, 111, as well as other cases that are cited on page 27 of our opening brief. So it would be a mistake in this case to focus only on the knowledge of facts about the injury and its cause alone. That predicate liability of Dr. Clemens is certainly an essential part of a claim based on the respondeat superior doctrine. But those are not the only material elements to a claim based on respondeat superior. And as we've argued, based on the theory of respondeat superior and based on the jury instructions that relate to that claim, it also has to be shown the existence of the employer-employee or principal-agent relationship and that the employee or agent was acting within the scope of his employment at the times of the events that are complained of. Now, and that employment or agency subsumes other factors that are outlined in the brief. So our contention is those are certainly essential elements of the claim against Associates in General and Vascular Surgery, which, just for simplicity, I'm going to refer to as the PC. Okay. So now, there is no dispute in this case as to when Mr. Everson actually had knowledge of all of the material facts, and that came in October of 2004. The reason for that was that that's when he received disclosures that revealed Dr. Clemens being an employee with the PC during the relevant time period. And that was later confirmed in a deposition that was taken by the plaintiff of Dr. Clemens, which is also outlined in the brief. However, he had no prior knowledge before that time. And in fact, as outlined in Mr. Everson's affidavit, which again is the only evidentiary material on his state of actual knowledge, his review of billing records, his review of other materials that were made available or which were sought by him, only showed billings by Memorial Hospital for the trauma services in this case. There were no bills, no medical bills from Associates in General Vascular Surgery, from the PC. There were no other materials indicating the existence of the PC. The PC was simply an undisclosed employer. And in saying that, I'm not criticizing the PC. I'm not saying that they set out to fraudulently conceal their existence. I'm not suggesting that for a moment. But what I am saying is that the effect of all the facts that were reasonably available to Mr. Everson, acting with reasonable diligence in this case, did not reveal their existence until October of 2004. So the question...
Remind me, how did Mr. Everson come to know those facts?
He received a disclosure from Dr. Clemens that was dated October of 2004. And one of the parts of that disclosure is attached as I think it's attachment one to the brief, along with his affidavit. He refers to it. And you'll see Dr. Clemens' CV. Dr. Clemens' CV indicates that he was in private practice with Associates in General and Vascular Surgery during a period. So that's the first inkling that he had. And then subsequently he corroborated that fact in a deposition of Dr. Clemens. Now I don't want to spend a whole lot more of my time on the statute of limitations issue, except to remind this court that you review the summary judgment on the statute of limitations defense de novo. And as part of your review, you're looking at exactly the same record of the summary judgment proceedings as were before the trial court. There were no counter affidavits that were presented on behalf of the PC specifically with respect to Mr. Everson's or Susan Everson's state of knowledge prior to October of 2004. So unless you find that the facts were undisputed, either that he knew, and our contention is you can't possibly find on this record that he had actual knowledge anytime before October 2004, or that he should have known based on the exercise of reasonable diligence, then it's your duty to reverse this this summary judgment based on the affirmative statute of limitations defense. The defendant here, the PC, had the burden of proof, both the initial burden of proof and the ultimate burden of proof on its affirmative defense here, to show that it was entitled to judgment as a matter of law and that the facts were not in dispute, the material facts were not in dispute.
Is it your position then that knowledge of the defendant's identity is a prerequisite to the commencement of the running of the statute of limitations, even though a plaintiff may know he or she is injured and know the cause of the injury?
I think that is the logical consequence of the Supreme Court's holding that a claim for relief does not accrue until the plaintiff knows or should know all material facts essential to show the elements of that cause of action and a proper understanding of the elements of a cause of action based on respondeat superior.
Mr. Sachs, I did not see any case cited in your brief, and I'm wondering if you have any authority that indicates that a cause of action based on respondeat superior does not accrue until the plaintiff knows who the potential party is that could have respondeat superior liability.
Based on my research to date, I have not found any controlling case law in Colorado, but I believe that the analysis that we have provided is sound based on settled precedent of this court and the Supreme Court. I think that it's because in the usual case, the parties are not dealing with a totally undisclosed corporate employer. And the facts here should indicate to you that a reasonable person in Mr. Everson's shoes, you know, who is being treated at a present-day hospital by a trauma surgeon as well as other people, would not have assumed that those individual healthcare providers were employees of some other undisclosed entity. And in fact, our original complaint alleged a respondeat superior claim. That theory was known and within the contemplation of the plaintiff early on in this case, at the earliest stage of this case. However, the plaintiff had it wrong. Based on the available information he had, he thought reasonably that it was Memorial Hospital where the complaint of acts occurred. He later found out that he was in error, and subsequently he moved to amend within the period of limitations. The purpose of the statute of limitations would be served by a ruling that by this court that it is not to cut out claims in these circumstances where the plaintiff does not know or have any reason to know of a non-disclosed corporate employer.
Mr. Sachs, I want to make sure I get a chance to ask you this question. If this court were to rule against your position on the statute of limitations issue, would that then render moot the non-party at fault designation issue?
I believe so. But for the reasons that follow, I think that we're entitled to also a determination on that issue. That involves the pro rata liability statute. And our contention in this case is that under Freed versus Long, the law is clear in Colorado that when you have a situation involving the pre-presentment negligence of an alleged non-party at fault, that is not relevant for the purposes of determining apportionment of liability. It may be relevant to apportionment of damages issues, which was addressed in the Freed decision, but it doesn't support a non-party designation. Otherwise, you could have a situation where there is, for example, a melanoma and a failure to diagnose case, and the patient ought to have known, or the patient's parents ought to have known, to use sunscreen, and everyone who had a duty to warn or to tell that patient, you know, that who later develops melanoma, you should have used sunscreen. You have the situation where in a failure to diagnose case, that every person who had some duty to the plaintiff or the plaintiff himself can share in the total apportionment of liability in the case. In this case, don't be deceived. The pro rata liability, the designation of non-party, was only the first step. Subsequently, at trial, the defendant was going to ask for an instruction to the jury that, based on Powell versus Brady and based on the restatement section, that the original tortfeasor in a case such as this is responsible for all damages, including damages that are caused by the subsequent medical malpractice of the treating physicians. So it was exactly like the situation in Freed versus Leong, where the jury was led to apportion liability, not just for the subsequent negligence of the healthcare provider in that case, but also for all the pre-presentment negligence of a host of other actors. And this court determined properly in that case that it was irrelevant to the issue of apportionment of damages, and that sort of designation is not appropriate under the pro rata liability statute in Colorado. So I have a minute. I'm going to try to reserve a minute. Thank you so much.
You remain there. Go ahead and stop the time, bailiff. I want to clarify. You referred to Miller versus Armstrong, and you referred to a Supreme Court case. Now, Miller versus Armstrong was a Court of Appeals case. What is the Supreme Court case to which you are referring?
Well, to my understanding, Miller versus Armstrong World Industries was a Colorado Supreme Court case. The Colorado Court of Appeals case was Skyland Metro District versus Mount West LLC, 184 P3rd 106.
Okay. We'll check that. Thank you. But that is the case. that's the case to which you're referring and that you believe to be the Supreme Court case?
I believe so. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Elizabeth Moran, registration number 16119, and I represent the defendant appellee, Associates in General and Vascular Surgery, PC, which I'll refer to as Associates. As you've heard, Associates is the employer of Dr. Clemens, who was the trauma surgeon who evaluated Mr. Everson when he was brought to the hospital after his motorcycle accident. Associates wasn't sued initially in the case, which was filed in March of 2004, but were brought in a year and a half later in October 2005 when the plaintiff moved to amend, claiming that he hadn't known before that Dr. Clemens was employed by Associates and not by Memorial Hospital. The material facts are undisputed, and most of the legal principles in this case are undisputed. First of all, it's undisputed that we have a 2-year statute of limitations that applies here. It's also undisputed that accrual is governed by 1380.108(1), the rule of accrual for personal injury actions, and that says that a cause of action accrues when the plaintiff is aware or in the exercise of reasonable diligence should be aware of both his injury and its cause. It's also undisputed that at least as to the doctors in the hospital, Mr. Everson's cause of action accrued in April 2002. At that time, he was aware that he had been injured. He was aware that he had suffered paralysis and required amputation of his legs. He was also aware at that time, because he claims to have received an anonymous phone call from someone at the hospital, that there had been mistakes during his hospitalization. So he knew of his injury, he knew of mistakes in his hospitalization, and he went and hired an attorney. The plaintiff, in fact, did not dispute that as to the doctors in the hospital, the cause of action accrued at that point in time, April 2002, and would have lapsed in April 2004. And in fact, the plaintiff admitted that in response to our motion for summary judgment at page 12 of that response. What the plaintiff argues here is that a different rule of accrual applies for a vicarious liability claim against an employer, even though it's simply a secondary liability claim that's based on the acts of a primary tortfeasor, in this case, Dr. Clemens, that a different rule applies and it does not accrue when plaintiff is aware of his injury and the fact that it was due to mistakes in hospitalization, but that it only accrues later when he learns that Dr. Clemens is not employed by Memorial Hospital, as plaintiff assumed, but is employed by a professional corporation. There is not any support in Colorado law for this argument. The plaintiffs have not cited any case and have not presented any reasoned explanation of policy basis why a different rule should apply to a vicarious liability claim against an employer than applies to all of the other defendants in this case. The statute at issue, the accrual statute, does not support the plaintiff's argument. The statute only requires, in order for accrual to occur, that the plaintiff be aware of his injury and its cause. Cause is simply, in the words of the Supreme Court in Mastro versus Brody, that the plaintiff is aware that his injuries are due to the wrongful conduct of another. The identity of that other, the particular legal theory of respondeat superior, or the details of his claim, those are not elements of accrual. Accrual occurs when the injury is known or should be known, and the cause is known or should be known.
What about his reference to the Miller case?
The Miller case does contain the statement that accrual occurs when the plaintiff knows all the material facts of the cause of action. But that case related, as I recall, to determining when the plaintiff discovered an injury. It was, I think, an asbestos case, and an issue about whether development of this sort of precondition was actually knowledge of an actual injury occurring. So it was used in a completely different context, and I think certainly did not undermine the previous statements of the court that injury and cause are all that's required for accrual, and that's what the statute says. So I don't think that Miller, the facts of Miller, on its facts, can be read to support the argument that the plaintiff is making in this case. It was not, certainly not an issue of vicarious liability claim or having knowledge of persons involved or the identity of employers. So while it does use that phraseology, it doesn't go very far in this case, I believe. The case law in Colorado has consistently told us that knowing the identities of the persons who are responsible is not a requirement of accrual. That it's not necessary that the plaintiff have knowledge of the legal theories that he is going to proceed on. And that accrual doesn't wait until the plaintiff has identified everyone who is involved or potentially liable. Now, we don't have a case that talks about this in the context of a vicarious liability claim, but there are at least three decisions of panels of this court that hold that not the fact that the plaintiff doesn't know the identities of the persons involved does not prevent a cause of action from accruing and does not toll the statute of limitations. And those cases, which are cited in our brief, are Chamblin versus Mickey and Fox, and that concerned a plaintiff's claim that they were not aware that engineering defendants in a construction defect case were potentially liable in addition to a contractor. And so the argument that their cause of action against the engineering defendants didn't accrue until they knew of their involvement and potential liability, that was rejected by the court. Similarly, in Kohler versus St. Germain Investments and in Grogan v. Taylor, the court has emphasized that not knowing of a particular legal theory or the identity of specific defendants does not prevent a case from accruing. Accrual is not delayed. That's what the two-year limitations period is for. Once a plaintiff is aware that he has been injured and he knows that it's due to wrongful conduct of someone, he has 2 years to discover who's at fault, all the people who are at fault, all the people who might have respondeat superior liability for those actors, and he can delineate the legal theories he's going to proceed on, whether he has a respondeat superior claim against somebody, whether there's an agency relationship, what other kinds of claims he's going to bring. He's got 2 years to do that once he knows of his injury and that it's due to the wrongful conduct of another. Finally, the plaintiff's argument is not supported by any rational public policy. The purposes of a statute of limitations is to encourage prompt resolution of claims and to prevent the litigation of stale claims. A vicarious liability claim, as I mentioned, is secondary liability for the actions of a primary tortfeasor, in this case, Dr. Clemens. There's no reason to subject the corporation to a different accrual period later in time than the claim that accrues against Dr. Clemens, especially when the plaintiff has had 2 years from the discovery of his injury and his cause in order to proceed to find out who is the doctor's employer. And especially here, as the plaintiff has pointed out, the argument is that in order for a vicarious liability claim to accrue, the plaintiff has to know of the legal relationship, the identity of the employer, and that the employee was acting in the scope of his employment. Well, with respect to scope of employment particularly, that could delay accrual of the statute of the cause of action indefinitely, because who knows how long it could take for a plaintiff to determine either through the employee or by trying to contact his employer what his scope of employment was and whether he was really acting within the scope of employment. In fact, that's often an issue that remains disputed throughout a case, so theoretically, the cause of action might never accrue. The trial court correctly held that the statutes of limitations began to run on April 2002, when the plaintiff was undisputedly aware that he had been injured and was aware that his injuries were due to mistakes during his hospitalization. There was no reason to apply a different rule to associates in general vascular surgery, because the cause of action against them accrued at the same time as it accrued against everyone else.
Pardon me, Ms. Moran, I want to ask you the same question I asked your opponent here. If the court were to rule against the plaintiff on the statute of limitations issue, would that then render moot the other issue with regard to the non-party at fault designation?
Yes, I agree it would render that issue moot. And that anticipates what I was next going to say, that the court does not need to reach that issue, but I do want to make a couple of brief comments about it. Ms. Landgraf was the driver who caused the injuries that took Mr. Everson to the hospital. I think what is important for this court to remember in reviewing the Freed versus Leon case against this case is that Freed does not deal with the issue of the Powell versus Brady rule. And that rule, which is applicable in this case, is that a tortfeasor who causes an injury that requires medical treatment remains liable not only for the injuries that took the plaintiff to the healthcare provider, but for any negligence in the medical treatment. The Powell case is not mentioned in the Freed versus Leon case. I don't know if it was argued in that case. At any in any event, it was not addressed by the court. But what we have here is we have a driver who, as a matter of law, is liable for the injuries she causes in the motorcycle accident and for the injuries, if any, that resulted from any negligent care that Mr. Everson received in the hospital. With respect to the hospital care, she shares responsibility with the doctors as a hospital if they were negligent. And that is what is appropriate for allocation under 1321.111.5. The acts don't have to occur at the same time. They don't have to be the same type of acts. It's sufficient if all of the acts were instrumental in causing the injuries. And as a matter of law, Ms. Landgraf's negligence in hitting Mr. Everson on his motorcycle was instrumental in causing the injuries that he ended up with. So she remains liable for his injuries that he incurred in the hospital, if any. I think, as the trial court appreciated, the Freed versus Leon case, in addition to the fact it didn't deal with the Powell rule, it was also quite different factually. In that case, the plaintiff was seeking psychological counseling from the defendant for psychological injuries she had incurred from abuse that had occurred many years earlier. And her psychological condition was aggravated by her psychologist's boundary violations. Here we have a continuum of injury. The events and the injuries that developed in this case occurred over an 8-hour period of time, from the accident to Mr. Everson's immediate transport to Memorial Hospital, where he was immediately evaluated, taken to surgery, then to the ICU, and within that span of time, it was then determined that he had no feeling from his chest down, and that then the problem with the aortic dissection, which had occurred in the accident, was identified. So I think from the standpoint of looking at this as a continuing injury rather than a static pre-existing condition, as was the case in Freed, the trial court here found that that was a distinguishing characteristic. I think if in the event that the court reaches this issue, the distinctions between this case and Freed in terms of the lack of application of the Powell rule in Freed and the different factual circumstances require a different result, and that the trial court in this case did correctly rule that the jury could allocate responsibility for injuries suffered in the hospital between Ms. Landgraf, the driver, and the doctors in hospital, should it reach that point. I would ask the court affirm both rulings of the trial court, and I thank the court for its time. If there are no further questions, I'll simply sit down.
Thank you, Ms. Moran.
Thank you.
In this case, there's absolutely no question from the very inception of this case, the Eversons knew their legal theory based on vicarious liability. It's part of the original pleadings in this case that were presented. So there's no issue about whether or not they had knowledge of the legal theory. The issue is whether or not they acted with reasonable diligence in bringing their action against associates. The trial court, based on disputed facts, resolved that issue adversely to the Eversons, and that was an issue for the jury to resolve only. So embodied within the statute is this concept of reasonable diligence, and that's not only to ensure that the focal point is not just simply on the plaintiff's subjective knowledge, but it's on the objectively reasonable conduct of a reasonable person acting with reasonable diligence. Now, in this case, the facts could lead a reasonable fact finder to conclude that the Eversons were certainly acting with reasonable diligence, and that, simply put, the PC in this case was an undisclosed employer, and no reasonable person under the circumstances would have known. My only other point is that my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sachs. Thank you, Ms. Moran. Case is now submitted, and opinion will issue in due course.
Okay.